I have a question. It's related to getting lost in thought, whether in formal meditation or just in daily life. Often I find myself just getting lost in thought without being aware. Perhaps it doesn't happen to anybody else. sometimes then you become aware, and then you're aware, and you find that you're lost in thought again, and then you become aware. And sometimes it's short time that you're aware, or sometimes a long time, sometimes short or long that one is lost in thought. Now, if I was here on, say, a Mahasi-style retreat, probably the teacher would say something like, when you're aware, just be aware, that, and then you just come back to the primary object of meditation.
Yeah.
Now, in Sayadaw's teaching, there is no
primary
object to come back to, so I was just wondering, more something if Sayadaw could say something helpful about how to deal with it in all those times one becomes aware that one has been lost in thought, and how to help make the lost in thought less and the being aware.
Primary object of the mind, that can I go to the other group of the mind? Primary object of the mind.
ဒီလိုက်တွေးမှာအတိမပြလိုက်ဟိုလူတရားကအဲ့လောစတင်ကမျောပါတာနည်းပြီးတော့ဒီရှိတာများလာအောင်လို့ပြောတာအဲ့တော့တွေးကိုကြားယူကြည့်တွေးကိုကြားယူကြည့်နေကြွားကြည့်နေလို့မျောမျောတော့လာအဲ့တော့ဒီလိုက်ခဏပဲပြန်လာတယ်ဒီလိုက်ခဏပဲပြန်ပြန်လာတယ်မျောပါတာအတွေးကိုကြည့်လို့မျောတာလည်းမဟုတ်တစ်ခါလေးတော့မှတိမေးဘူးမဟုတ်ပါဘူးမျောပါတာမတတ်နိုင်ဘူးโอเคโอเคတော့ဆရာတော်ကဆက်ဝင်သားဝင်မိပြီဒါမှမဟုတ First, we just get lost in thought. He said you can't help that, so forget about it. When you lose your thought, when you get lost in thought, you realize you just become, start being aware again. Mm-hmm. And you can be aware of anything again. You can have a primary object if you want or not, you know, whatever. Second reason for getting lost in thought is, he says, when we have thinking and we're trying to observe thinking, and we don't know how to recognize that thinking is the mind or thinking is an object, we look at what the thoughts are about, and then we can get sucked into thinking. So if the tendency is to do that, then he says, don't spend too much time observing thought.
Yep.
Recognize as a thought, and then be aware of other things as well. Recognize as thought and be aware of other things as well. And then the third way to deal with it is to be aware of the awareness when you are observing a thought. That if you're able to remember the awareness when observing a thought, you're less likely to get sucked in because you're aware of the presence of the awareness.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can't do that, again, you will get sucked into the thought.
Okay.
Yes.
I've been a member of a number of public protests and demonstrations.
Yes.
Against political injustice and destruction of the environment.
Yes.
And there's often a lot of anger around one.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if Saigo has any ideas on how to maintain mindfulness when participating in something like that.
Mm.
It's easy to get drawn into the
environment or PSCDAO throughout protest You have to stay in yourself. Not
ability, I don't know that. That is what they are like. Exactly.
Yeah, he says there, for them, the whole motivation to in coming is the anger towards the injustice. So there is going to be anger all around. So you have to stay within yourself and not pay too much attention. It's like going into a fire. You've got to wear a protective vest.
Fireproof.
Because there's fire all around.
Yeah.
He said he's had to mediate between two very angry people. Armed with his awareness. Armed with his mindfulness, full knowledge of himself and mind and so on, and then didn't take any sides and slowly dealt with it.
But I feel very strongly, I'm quite partisan on that, and I feel I have to make a statement. So
yes.
I have a placard.
Sure.
Saying the words.
Yes.
That I want to say.
Yes.
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 Yeah.
He says the trick is, you know, he says to say what you need to say, to say what needs to be said, to state what needs to be stated, but not to put the attention too much outwards. You know, so for example, he accepted that they're both in this state, but he stayed more within himself to ensure that whatever he said or stated came from a place of, you know, the right understanding and the right view and so on. And he did what he had to do. He didn't get sucked into their stories.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so. So being very aware of what's happening in yourself, being aware that you're looking, what you're trying to stand up for, how you would want to do it, what you feel should be stated, and so on. Being aware, very aware of that as you do it.
Mm-hmm.
He says, and he also had a plan before he went. You know, he played scenarios in his head because he knew how angry they were, what they might say, and so on. Just as you might have an idea of what it would be like when you go there. So you imagine what you would do to be mindful, what you would try to be mindful of when you're there, and then that will help you to do all that. He says his tendency initially had been to side with his mother, but then he noticed that every time he took a side, whether it was right or wrong, then he'd get burned. He'd get blasted as well. So he knew he had to really not be biased in order to just get them to see each other's point of view.
I'm not trying to mediate.
Yeah.
I feel strongly I have a similar idea about with all the angry people around me.
Yes.
I have similar.
But you don't want to.
Thoughts,
want to
and I don't want
anger.
To participate in the
anger. But in the idea.
But
yeah.
In the idea.
Yeah.
I feel.
Right, so the idea, that idea, he said, is similar, that you want to fulfill your objective without anger getting in the way.
Yeah.
And that's what you have to imagine, and you have to imagine how you want to do that when you get that.
Like your placard could say, "You protest underneath without anger." Can I just make another comment on that thing?
Protest like a smile.
In those situations of public protest,
yes.
There tends to be a very strong feeling of righteous anger.
Yes.
And then everyone around is
yes.
Right. So one gets very attached to that feeling
yeah.
of righteousness, and that's actually quite attractive.
So yeah. If you can see that attachment, to think, oh, I'm so right and they're so wrong. And there's a very strong feeling of that.
Yeah, attitude is very important.
That's true.
What attitude are you doing this? This is very important. If your attitude is wrong, you become bad.
Sorry, I just want to go back to that awareness. It's very easy to get pulled, well, I find it easy to get pulled into trying to work out the defilement by using thought.
Yes.
Right. So then I do go to try and see that as a knowing. Yes. The question is can you not make that seer, that knower, the object, to continually try to be, instead of falling into what you're hearing?
Yes, you can see the knower and make that the object. What? He uses different words sometimes, but basically so that, you know, observing the awareness or knowing the awareness or knowing the watching mind or whatever, all that is what you're just
so saying. That's basically the whole thing is to fall back into that continually. If
you can continually recognize the knower. Because so long as you are conscious of the knower continues to know. And you, because, yeah, it's feeding itself, right? When we're not conscious or acknowledging or recognizing the knower, he says then we're not sure whether the knower is at work or not, whether we've got sucked into the object or we're knowing the object.
เสียเสียจริงๆนี่เลยว่ะเออนักกุญญ์เนี่ยต้องอยากชื่อเออต้องกุญญ์เลี้ยงชื่อเลี้ยงว่ามีไงนะครับผมเอ๊ะตัวนี้เนี่ยชื่อโชว์โชว์มั้ยโชว์อู้ไอ้ตัวนี้เนี่ยชื่อโชว์โชว์มั้ยไม่ใช่อู้ไอ้ตัวนี้ชื่อเนี่ยโชว์โชว์มั้ยเออตัวนี้ชื่อเนี่ยชื่อโชว์โชว์มั้ยอืมไอ้ตัวนี้ชื่อเนี่ยชื่อโชว์โชว์มั้ยอืมไอ้ตัวนี้ชื่อเนี่ยชื่อโชว์โชว์มั้ยอืมไอ้ตัวนี้ชื่อเนี่ยชื่อโชว์โชว์มั้ยอืมไ
So you you know, whatever we see, whatever we are aware of, if we're aware of three things, he says, you know there is a fourth thing, because that's what's seeing the three.
Mm.
If you know two things, there's three things actually, because the third thing is seeing.
Okay.
If you know four things, there is a fifth, which is seeing the four. So you must remember this. Yeah. Sounds like a movie, you know, like the fifth kind.
Continuing with the same question, when your formations are reasonably calm and you're reasonably sure that your awareness is in contact with the object, and you begin to investigate a little towards the knower.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to be quite very, very subtle, and I'm just asking, is that a little bit like a subtle waiting, like a subtle ambience?
Mm.
Is that it's hard to find something that's not the awareness and the object together. It's hard to find something beyond, like the fourth thing. It seems to be very subtle. Is that like a weight in that? Like an
ambience? Oh, yes, I understand what you mean. Look, you're here. Yes, you can see that it's a sort of vedana, recognizing that it's there. Everything we know because we feel it. Everything is known because of vedana.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. We know everything through the vedana of it.
So in that knowing, is language not necessary? Like, is it just being aware of a kind of feeling state?
It's not important to have language, directly experience or sense something, yes.
And
then we put lots of names to it, you know, we call it, yeah, etc., etc.
So what you're saying is the knower is the knowing? Like when you're knowing.
Is the knowing, knower. Yes. The knower is the knowing. And like,
the knower is the knowing, yes.
We use different words like the knower, the seer, the knowing, the watching mind, all that. We use so many different words to try to get everybody to understand the same thing. But it's definitely not person.
So at the moment, that we become aware, though. The moment we know that we're aware, or we are aware of the knower, there is a moment of recognition there. And is that like a... that's a thought. That we can't know we're aware without there being a thought there. Mm-hmm. So in a way...
Yes, that is thought, yes.
So in a way...
when we have... when we there's the recognition, there's always already been a thought. Because our our mind's natural habit has always been to identify things with words. That's how we know things, all the concepts. So when the thought has come about what we're experiencing, that's when we're very sure. I have experienced this. Yes, and that's when the memory of it is also much stronger. Once we have described it to ourselves. Yes, sometimes we experience things, we've not put any word to it. We know we've experienced it, but it's easy to let those experiences go by and not really retain them. Yeah.
So at the moment before that naming is applied, though, there is that, like a Vedana, a recognition in an amorphous sense.
Correct, yes. Hello, the he says it is upon what we already know that we then give meaning, we define, we describe. He says this teacher from America, she describes it quite well. She says when she watches thoughts, she says thoughts come in words, right, and through our mind. And she says when she looked at the beginning of the thought, it stopped, but she already knew the thought. So her mind didn't have to spell it out completely. That's how subtly the mind has already done the thinking. The fact when by the time the sentence has come out in our heads, it's a very gross level thought. But at a very subtle level, we've already done the thinking, the giving meaning. Sometimes the whole story can be over in a split second in our minds. He says, and whether we individually, you know, whether our minds then express it in words or images, He says, so by the time it becomes actual words in our head, he said the process is really very long done in the beginning of the process was much earlier, a very subtle level. Sometimes we may recognize there was a thought, but it doesn't come up to the gross level. We know there was a thought, but we don't know what we were thinking. We just know that the mind seems to have done something. Sometimes the mind is singing.
So just to follow that, I mean, it is the instruction to, in order to confirm awareness is present, is it important to have that word in your head, awareness is present? Or, I mean, does that help it continue on like that? Or is that just getting in the way with more words?
Just depends on the person, I think. Mm-hmm. Or the where you're at. Do what? The Kalong Tong Girl. The deep beach has seen it. Kokubo, Piovolula, Mahoenda, Atapia Naila. He says there is some natural labeling, he calls labeling, or like he describes, there's some natural thinking that the mind does about what it's experiencing. It just tells itself. Mm-hmm. Our mind naturally tells ourselves what we're experiencing. That's fine, he says. Whether you want to put in that extra conscious label, or he says, for the very, very beginners, he says, the use of a word or a label is in, it directs the mind to towards an object. Because just like the asking of a question indicates the answer for the mind. In the same way, when the mind says to itself, rising, falling, the attention naturally goes there.
Mm.
And that's why it's helpful for a beginner.
Right.
But after a while, you can recognize the subtle, natural intonations of the mind. Okay.
When the mind is resting in awareness, it seems difficult to have a thought whilst the mind is resting in awareness. It's almost, often the instruction is to watch the thought, but whilst watching happens, if a thought arises, the resting in awareness has reduced. So it kind of seems mutually exclusive to watch and think.
Think.
It's kind of tricky to explain.
Well, resting in awareness,
He says
yes, when the awareness is strong, it is difficult to think intentionally. There is a level of thoughts that is subconscious or So at the conscious level, yes, when the awareness is strong, you can't really think, and when you think, you can't really be, you don't seem to be so aware. That's at a very gross level. At a subtle level, he says there's levels of thinking that never stop. Even if you're asleep, those thoughts don't stop. And then they manifest as dreams and so on. So it's that level of thinking that you can actually be aware of and not lose your awareness, although they don't stop. But at the conscious level, yes, when you're aware, it feels like you're resting because you're not doing anything extraneous, you know, not any of this conscious at the conscious level, if we're not aware, the mind does a lot of conscious thinking, you know, cross thinking, and that thinking takes up a lot of energy. It saps us by energy because it's not necessary sometimes.
He says
there are some beginners, he tells them to, you know, recognize thinking whenever it arises. And because there's a lot of this gross level thinking, they keep trying to recognize it and recognize it. And he says, oh, it's so tiring. And then the thinking reduces. He's so tired of thinking. He recognized it so much.
My question is more or less the reverse. When one's mind is very calm, I can see the thought almost straight away. Sometimes even as it starts. Then I recognize it and it goes away. So it seems, especially since the beginning of this course, that I seldom can actually investigate the thought. Because the thought is never there. As soon as it comes up, I realize and it
disappears.
It's gone. So, why I'm asking that question is because Sayadaw says thinking is always there. So you have to investigate
deeper.
I just wondered whether I'm deluding myself that I have no thoughts.
Only at the gross level.
Yeah.
But not at the subtle levels.
But I can't see the thought. So it's not there. For me, it's not there.
Oh, but I think they
will all but think they will. It's just that the awareness that you have is not able to recognize the subtle thinking yet.
Yeah.
That's all. But at the gross level, it knows the mind is not thinking.
And once the thought isn't there, there's no thought, because I've been trained in a method that you go to the body, I just wait for my awareness to direct me to whatever is prominent.
Yes.
And I go with that.
Okay.
And is that the correct?
The deal, some chi line, the dia dua to be I to cook an akuma you read.
Just continue. Internal dialogue, monologue, or shit.
He says this subtle level thinking. Internal dialogue. He says, it's what we are, it's how we function. We do everything because our internal dialogue tells us to do it. Whether it's to wait for that awareness to see where it'll go, and then it goes to parts of your body and all, that's all directed. But you don't see it. And that's the subtle level thinking. You think that I did it by itself, but he said it's like right there in the back of our heads. It's directing the show, but but we're not used to turning back and saying, "Oh, you're telling," and then recognizing, "Oh, this is telling me to." This is directing, and those are thoughts. We don't recognize that. So sometimes it's there, but we don't even realize this is the thought. These are the thoughts he's talking about. For example, when there's no thought, your mind has already said to you, there's no thought now. Now it's aware. But you don't know it's thinking. In that internal dialogue is all our motivations. It's the real reasons we do things, whether we really have metta or a defilement or whatever behind our actions. It's in there. Yeah.
To go back to something similar, for example, I was watching the flies on my face and they were running around. And then I examined my mind, there were no aversion, but there were interest.
Yes.
And then I could feel that someplace it was more sensitive than others.
Yeah.
Mm.
So I just kept their interest and then they flew away. So is that what we're supposed to be doing? Mm. Just investigating this?
This is what he calls waiting and watching. You know, you just
wait.
Interested,
yeah.
And then
but you go check your mind whether there is. Sorry. You go back and check your mind whether you are generating aversion to the flies or
Yes, he always checks back and forth.
Okay.
You know what this
experience is.
If we often, you know the experience and check how we're reacting to it, he says gets to the point where you're always aware of your reaction when you know your experience. Yeah. It becomes natural to know both.
With regards to knowing the mind, what I find hardest is finding when I'm neutral, where there's no greed or aversion, just neutrality.
And you find it hard to do
to determine whether
it might be
what's just neutral, whether I just don't have any aversion or greed for what's happening.
Neutral, it might be that feeling.
So just recognize it's neutral. It's a feeling. Yeah. A lot of people say at that time that they have no feeling. There is no feeling. But it's not no feeling, it's just a neutral
feeling. It is a feeling. Neutral feeling.
Because we think pleasant or unpleasant is a feeling, but neutral is also a
feeling.
And we must recognize it for what it is. This is a neutral feeling, yeah.
So by definition, there's always some feeling, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral.
Yeah, always.
Vedana is one of the five. Every mind has a Vedana in it,
Does it ever get to a point where thinking stops?
Sorry. Does it ever get to a point
when thinking stops?
He says at the gross level we can know quite easily, you know, there's no thinking. He said that subtle level thinking, he said sometimes when we get very deep into when the mindfulness is very continuous and very deeply interested, sometimes it can get where those subtle thoughts are very, very short. Like they don't do so much work anymore because they're not busy, you know, then there might just be a little bit here and there. But at that level, he says, the natural functions of the mind, you know, where the mind naturally, it knows what's happening. Therefore, there's the thoughts about what's happening, there's the understanding of what's happening, and all that. All those thoughts
are opinion.
Yeah. It takes concept, it understands these are the concepts, you know, there's distance, the concepts involved and all that. All that you can't stop, that's automatic.
Now, I see that you can do it. I don't mean only.
Another thought that we have is the sense of I, or sense of me. It's a thought that we hold. An idea, but we don't see it. We don't see it as an idea. It's so pervasive in the mind. We use words that always indicate to us the sense of self. You know, we say, I do this, this is my shoe, this is my place, she's talking to me. So we use it, so there is this, that's the indication of that idea present in the mind, but it's difficult to catch it. How many times do we notice during a day the use
of
this reference, you know, in our thoughts, in our interactions with people and situations? Have we noticed how much we reference the eye? We don't even notice that.
Even the hair fall down my hair.
Women comb their hair and it falls on the floor.
But it's very hard, our plan consciously not to use I, especially when writing or talking.
Mm.
And it's very hard to communicate without using it.
What he said just now about the use of the word being an indication of the idea, he says, at the same time, we can't not use the words.
Yeah.
Yes? They are a tool to function in this world. But, he says, what we want to recognize is that we are using it, and whether in the moments that we use it and reference it, are we using it as a tool, recognizing that it's just a reference, or are we fully... When our understanding of the fact that it's a reference and our reality becomes more, you know, as we recognize it more and more, and we recognize it, he says, then the belief in the reference becomes less. We're more able to recognize in the moment that we need to use it as a reference and not as a repeater. Like, yeah.
Before meditation, we thought I one, oh, very powerful. Everybody move. Later I want power this way. I angry so they go, oh gee, you very, you know.
He says, when you don't understand, he says, then when you're angry, then you believe how angry you are. But when you begin to understand, then you say, I'm angry, and then it's anger.
Yeah.
And you're not so fully
caught up
in how much you believe you're angry.
The idea you got power, you know.
There's not so much power in the idea that I am angry.
My teacher do it. Lucian aja lah, tuh. Aku tuh macam orang ni, tengah ni, terbawa. Aku tuh macam orang, lah. Iya, iya.
Oh iya, iya. His teacher, he said, very seldom used the word I. He would indicate by saying here, here. Only that makes sense. He said, belum kira, Dima.
Dima lah tu juga.
Yeah, he would say here is the same.
Is that why Sayadaw, in his writings, talks about like wisdom coming forth and so forth? So it's like a
wisdom coming forth.
Yeah, you know, like wisdom knows the way through, and he uses the abstracted sort of form of this concept rather than your knowing. So there's a kind of
so that we always realize that wisdom is wisdom and not my wisdom.
Something like that. Yeah.
The Buddha says, describe it that way. He says, the mind, for example, the mind and the greed that arises in the mind, recognize that greed has arisen in the mind. He describes it like that. And
he
says, when you become very familiar with the when the understanding that it's a reference becomes very, very strong. He says, whenever you use the word I, you become very conscious that you've used the word and that it's not really indicating yourself, you know, that it's indicating some quality. Yeah. He says, when we speak, he says the words we speak very often indicate what's behind, you know, what colors our view.
Yes.
Yeah.
Interestingly, in the suttas, the Buddha never referred to himself as I. He always said the Tathagata.
Yeah. He said, I Buddha. I don't know, it's not his translation.
Is this close to the question?
I am
Jina Udharamala.
Pali
Ramani Guru. Oh, Chahan Solo Singh. To Tabang Lu Singh. I don't want to do that.
It says, at least in Burmese translations, because he can't read the Pali.
Yeah.
He says there are references where, for example, at the end of a story he tells or about himself or something, he will say, at that time, I, the Buddha, was
something else.
Does this referencing of the I and the understanding of the I as a concept, as a reference point, is this an essential part of Sotapanna?
It's already understood. The Sotapanna understands clearly that the process of mind and matter is not a person.
Yes.
And because the Sotapanna understands clearly, he uses the word freely. He uses the references freely, but without ever feeling that it's a me. When he was practicing at home, and then by the time he agreed to get married, and then during his wedding, and he was still being mindful all the time. He says, particularly during the wedding, he noticed how many eyes there were, because, you know, he was going to get his own room, and, you know, and somebody else's slippers are there, what are they doing, you know, things like that. The noticing of how much I and belief in the I and I, he said, it felt, every time he saw his mind think it felt very loud and very prominent, because he could see how much the mind believed it. My life, and then particularly feeling that my life, my separate life is beginning with my family.
Could Saigo please expand a little with regard to the factors necessary for Sotapanna in this method, in this tradition? Expand upon the prerequisites for the arising of Sotapanna. What I call Sotapanna.
Yes.
Yeah. The factors of.
How do you become a Sotapanna?
Yes.
He says, that wisdom has to arise. Nobody can make you a Sotapanna, nobody can tell you how to practice particularly for yourself. Yes, as you watch your own mind, when that wisdom arises, that's when that person will know. He says, now it doesn't make any difference. You know, we only know the theory.
Okay, with regard to the I again,
on a subtler level, while I'm meditating, I can see the mind behind roaming around, scanning things, attaching to objects, and I'm watching it attach to objects.
Yeah.
And I can't help but think, oh, yeah, it's attaching to this object. I'm watching it attach to this object. It's attaching to this object. It's attaching to pain. I'm watching it attach to pain. But then there's always the eye that's watching the back of the mind working. So how can you escape that?
Now the watcher is me. Because now the watcher is more constant.
Yeah.
Yes?
It's almost like the watcher feels that the mind is kind of working for him or working against him.
Yeah.
Or working in parallel with him.
So you see how subtly the mind, everything else has become an object. So the mind says, oh, this is mine, this is mine, this is mine. Mm-hmm. But this is not changing. It seems to be the constant. And so then the mind attaches the eye to it. So then, that's why Siyama says you must recognize the knowing as well. Recognize the watcher. Then when you recognize the watcher, and all that's happening is a cycle, not a cycle, but a stream of watchers, knowing watchers, knowing watchers,
yes.
Knowing watchers, that's when, again, it becomes object, so it slightly less attachment to the eye. That was a Japanese yogi, his name is Hugo. So he said to Seattle, honestly, he says, I just can't wrap my head around it. There is a me. This is me. I can't believe there's no me. So Seattle said, okay, let's just start with the physical. Just remove your hair, your eyes, your ears, your
skin.
Just remove all of that, what's left. And he says, okay, he says, which part is you? So he said, okay, maybe not the physical, but he says, I am paying attention. He says, that's definitely me. I'm the one who's doing this work. Siyama said, okay, he says, and are you aware all the time? Are you paying attention all the time? Are you always there then? And he said, what about when you're asleep? You can't pay attention. Where are you?
Sometimes, if the watcher's being present for a while,
yes.
I intimately say, thank you, watcher. I feel like I'm distancing myself a bit from
yes.
Watcher. Just say, thank you, watcher.
The deep. So yes, in the acknowledgement, in thanking the watcher, he says you acknowledge that it's something centered again. Yeah, so that gives the backing up and recognizing it. Yeah.
Yeah,
that was very interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can I ask about the need and the purpose for piti, sukha, joy? The usefulness of piti,
yes,
for a death practice.
Mm.
As opposed to suffering or other disturbance.
Piti below your shin. Every wholesome, the strengthening of every wholesome state of mind brings piti. And it supports the strengthening of awareness,
samadhi,
and also wisdom. So piti also supports all that, just like samadhi does.
Piti ajam, the two ideas that you need.
Yeah, I mean in the Buddha, in the, you know, suttas and all, there are stories of people who have great joy, who have piti, and then use that as the object to observe, and then attain enlightenment because they understand the nature of. All wholesome states of mind support other wholesome states of mind.
I find that there are times when I have been meditating when there is a sort of a joy, but something happens and I'm moved, but I'm moved to tears very easily.
Yes.
It's not a sadness, but.
Yes.
Why is that?
Because we are talking about the name of Twitter. One Piti is. It's a wholesome state of mind, but it comes with slight agitation because it's joy.
I mean, yeah, exactly.
That's
fine.
That's not a problem.
Could that be gratitude?
Jesus, John, though, can I? Yes, possible because of gratitude.
I'm really looking for kids,
yeah. Just feel a bit embarrassed.
Oh, it's not going to happen. Shit, then. Yeah, you're 12.
Oh, I'm really looking for
kids. He says, it tends to have. Tears come more easily to women, he said.
This is the nature.
Just the nature of this.
One day at a time, one day at a time, joy at a time.
When we're happy, we cry. When we're sad, we cry. Feels good to him. Either way. Now that I'm down there, I think only a woman would say that. Maybe, I don't know.
Also, we're trying to follow one of those instructions of knowing the knower, I was sort of labeling because there's so much coming in, seeing, hearing, seeing, touching. So then it was too tiring recognizing all this.
Yes.
So then I just stopped.
Yes.
And I noticed something a bit like the lady over there said, a kind of a wrist, but it's like a wide. Experience.
Yes.
So nothing is focused on. It's just everything.
But everything is known.
And I feel like I'm just resting, or maybe I'm not doing.
He says, just stay like that for a while. It will change. Okay, so allow yourself to investigate that. Stay in that state and investigate what that brings. So the initial stage, he says, we all tend to do that in the beginning because we don't understand. It can be less tiring. But now the mind's understood that's tiring, so it's stopped. And then it's just new, but it will change you.
Yeah.
He says it's all a part of the process of learning to meditate. You know, there will be some states where we will find we need to be labeling and stuff like that, you know, to bring our attention and all that. And then after a while, the mind knows how to do it. Then it's just too much work. It's extra. It's not necessary. Then we drop that, and then we're left with this. And then, you know, and then other things happen.
The education of the people, now they just be people, leave that as well. I don't know. They might have it.
He says it's just like any field of, you know, when we study we have to put in effort, right? We spend our time learning mathematics, how to do this and that, algebra, etc., trigonometry, physics, and, you know, we try to memorize, we try to remember, we try to relate this to that, that. And then when you know it all, he says, then you don't need the books anymore. Initially, you have to put in that effort.
Yeah?
But once you are experienced, then you just look at a situation and you know why this happened. That's your understanding. Whatever you have been expertly researching or studying, that's what you will understand, and that's what will come to you in a flash when you see it. He says, for example, eye surgeons, he says they've studied for years, but what, you know, when they're skillful, they do the, you know, for example, cataract operations or eye surgeries very quickly. They already know what is significant, what is not, Always remember that meditation is not a static activity where one state is right. This is the right state of awareness, I got to keep this. No.
Now people, they start meditating, start again, pressing for me, anapana.
He says once your own wisdom is stronger, he says then in the beginning, he says we need to do this because that's how we're taught. That's our beginning exercises, the effort making that we need to do to get to the point where we understand the practice and we can just practice. Initially, he says, our practice is always sati first, effort, virya, samadhi, then wisdom is trailing quite far behind. We have some borrowed wisdom to apply the satis or virya so that we can get samadhi, and that's how we're working. And then he says, as we keep plodding along, little sparks of wisdom come to us, and then those become part of our arsenal. And then hopefully, slowly, the wisdom catches up, and then it's working together. Awareness, virya, samadhi, panya, all working together, sadha. And then he says, hopefully one day the wisdom gets so strong that it gets ahead. And then it's not the awareness at work anymore, it's the wisdom. So you're aware, but wisdom is the one that watches together with the awareness.
Awareness is a follower of wisdom.
Yeah, then wisdom is the leader and awareness just does its work. It becomes the worker. He says now, if he wants to go into a retreat like all of you and start following your schedule, it's tedious. He can't do that anymore. It's too stilted. It's artificial. He has to put in things that he doesn't need to put in. If he doesn't try to practice, it's there. Naturally, he's aware. And it's always there. He has noticed that when the practice is strong, when his awareness is strong and everything is working together very strongly, he says the feeling that he is meditating is absolutely not there at that time.
Mm.
Yeah, for those times.
I'm just wondering if that might be part of why Sayadaw's tradition seems to focus on getting rid of the defilements. Like Samatha tradition, Ajahn Brahm teaches very much about getting rid of the hindrances. It's focused on jhana being elimination of the hindrances.
But Sayadaw doesn't do that.
No. And so, but in his tradition, the way I'm understanding it, or his teaching,
it's
very much about focusing on where the defilements are, and trying to eliminate the defilements and grow the wholesome roots at the same time as a base for wisdom.
Sorry.
So,
let me just get what you're saying. You're saying that Sayadaw does or does not teach us to eliminate the defilements?
Very much to teach us to eliminate the defilements.
And the other one was what too?
Samatha tradition, which is very much about jhanas being absence of hindrances.
So, what is the difference between the jhanas and the absence of hindrances
and
the ways?
Yeah, I'm interested in Sayadaw's interaction of it's focused on getting rid of the defilements, isn't it? Rather than hindrances.
But the hindrances are defilements.
Yeah. Five
hindrances. It's just another name. It's just another categorization of it. But hindrances are defilements.
Yes. Mm. Just a different accumulation.
Five, three.
It's just those five, you know, but.
It's five instead of.
Yeah, all the hindrances are just different kinds of delusion. It's all different kinds of delusion, the hindrances.
But
the five hindrances are lower dosa and three kinds of moha, sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Kamachanda is lower. Vyabhara
is dosa, and then sloth and topa, kupuchan
is all moha. So
they
are the defilements. Yeah. When we practice satipatthana, then the defilements become objects of the observation. You spoke about eliminating defilements. I just want to clarify how Sayadaw approaches that. Pia tuwa, ashen pia are, ashen pia de de tema are, o di kile ta le o.
Ta po de mo chu, pe mo mo na le mo de, do na le mo da, pe mo du la mo.
Sayadaw's focus is not to eliminate the defilements. He says if we try to eliminate the defilements, we will only try to eliminate them with the
defilements.
Yeah, because we don't know how to eliminate. I think he said it in the evening group. He says we are full of delusion. We won't know how to get rid of something as skillful as the defilement. He says we have to rely on wisdom, which can deal with the defilements. He says so what we do is try to understand the defilements. How do they work? When do they
what
work?
Is this?
What is it? What is its nature? Yeah, we. So that's why it's an object of observation. So that from the investigation of it, when we learn more about it, then we can become free of it.
Wisdom,
but because the wisdom grows. So because when we investigate, inevitably, wisdom will grow, and it's wisdom that can eliminate the defilements. So we rely on wisdom. We don't try to eliminate the problems.
So wisdom being a process that just kind of we just hope that grows and happens apart from us, but we feed it, we cultivate it.
We cultivate it by with the mindfulness.
Yes, right.
Could you use what you just said about the defilement? Use a specific one, for example, anger.
Yes.
Then you investigate what is anger, what is it? How do you go that, through that process with one specific?
Maybe we should let Seattle tell a story.
Yes.
Maybe not everybody has heard the story, but
yeah.
It's in the book. It's called Pendulum.
Pendulum.
Yeah, green book. That's Seattle's own experience. He was sitting meditation. His Seattle always came into the meditation hall and did guided meditation like he does here. He loved it, and he would really try to hear what his teacher was saying. And his teacher sat on the left side of the hall, left side of him in the hall. His awareness was good, samadhi good, he's feeling peaceful. His teacher's voice is very soft. On the right side of him, outside the door of the Dhamma hall, somebody was making noise. He couldn't hear his teacher anymore. Instantly, his mind ran to the right side, to the noise. In the center, a ball of dosa rose up inside him. And in that peacefulness, that this ball of huge dosa rolled up in him, he was shocked. What's this? That's the question. What is this? Once he asked that question, instantly his mind went into that mode of checking what is happening now. Yeah. And this is what he saw. His mind ran to the left, trying to listen. He couldn't hear, he would run to the right. Complained about the noise. And then the ball of anger in the center rose.
Bigger.
It ran again, left, back and forth, and back and forth. He says, so the watching is very interested, but the anger was still going on. He was very interested, and he could see the mind bing bonging back and forth, and then after. So he could see everything. He could see the thoughts, the movement of the mind, the tension, the anger, the feelings, everything was known. But because of the interest, the mind saw the pattern. It's attached to his teacher's voice, and therefore it's angry that it's obstructed by this noise. And the moment he understood that the lobha is causing the dosa, it just dissolved. It's like puncturing a
car
tire.
And
then he understood clearly, dosa arises because of lobha inside ourselves. Instantly, the mind stopped clinging. And then it stopped being angry. Then it came back. Once he dropped it, it was peaceful again. But he didn't do this consciously. Yeah, he didn't try to analyze it. Or they say the realization hit him. That wisdom came in and understood.
Investigation now.
He only asked one question consciously. What is this? The rest of it, the mind did by itself.
And after when Saido couldn't hear the teacher still, what was the feeling like then?
He didn't try to hear anymore. He just did being mindful. I mean, he hears it every day. Yeah. He's attaching for nothing. You know, just mindless attachment. You know, senseless.
So that's why he said
the mind was really curious. why in such a moment, in such peacefulness, how can so much anger arise suddenly? So. Because of, you know, many of his experiences in the past, he says whenever situations change suddenly, his mind becomes alert. It wants to know what's happening. Everything. Yeah. It wants to know.
I am sitting with a lot of unpleasantness. And so I ask the question, what is this? And there is no answer, it's just unpleasantness.
Yeah.
It's partly aversion, but I just have to keep sitting with it, and that's all I can do. And there's nothing else really, is there?
So now you're gathering data. When there is enough data, the mind will come to its own conclusion. The question is always to generate interest. It's not to get an answer. We only ask the question to enable us to observe. We don't ask the question to get the answer.
So I don't need to. I guess how often do you ask the question when you observe? There's the unpleasantness again. What is it? And then
Yeah, he says you have to use your own experience and also all your own understanding, everything you know about life psychology, the Buddha Dharma, whatever, when there is interest, you may not even need to ask a question because the mind is interested. When the mind is not interested, you know, maybe when it's when it feels dull, disinterested, sleepy, maybe when it feels oppressed and so on, then you might.
Wisdom,
then you know wisdom is weak. You might want to look at the arsenal of wisdom you have and check which is the necessary one at this time or once. If you are interested in meditation, the Dharma, its benefits and all, I mean, you've got all this experience in your life through the Dharma, he says, then you know the mind will naturally seek to find its way. He said sometimes his teacher would come into the guided meditation sessions. He would just ask one question and leave. And he'd be left there, you know, struggling on his own with the question. Instead of say something and say, think about it. Then you leave. Of course, his teacher didn't mean to think about it, but to investigate that idea or whatever he had introduced.
Matip, when we were at the Serpentine Dam the other day, I was telling you a little bit about the thing that I'm sitting with, particularly on retreat in this setting, is about grief, and it's grief about the environment and how it's changing because of climate change.
Yes.
So I'm just wondering, I'm not quite sure what I'm asking this idol, but maybe just if some of the instruction he's just giving there is similar to my situation
too. Yeah. Climate change,
Oh, He says
the understanding that the grief comes from a feeling of loss. It's dosa. So to see the corresponding, what is it, the mind works that is causing the
Yes,
he says we have to try our best to mitigate unnecessary loss. Yes? But he says in the end, the last resort is again upekkha. When you cannot help it, you have to accept
it.
Because loss is natural. Loss is part of nature. And we have to come to terms with it. Our whole lives is full of one loss after the other. We are losing every moment. It's nature. When Sienna went to Europe, the car got stolen. And his luggage was in the car. So he lost everything. He lost his robes. He had only his robes on. They came into the room. They took the computer, the camera, the car keys. Yeah, it was quite scary. When he thought about his luggage and everything he had in there, he only felt lost for one thing in there. He had a book in there in which he'd written all his ideas over the 7 years or something, or 2 years he'd been writing at that time. And he felt a bit of a pang of loss for him. His mind kept telling him, oh, it's gone. What a loss. And he said, and of course he noticed it every time. He said, and then his mind would, you know, complaining, oh, it's gone, what a lot. He said it happened once, twice, right? By the fourth time, another mind said, he's gone, why you keep going on?
I can really relate to Joe. Yeah. One can deal a little bit like that with personal loss and go through all those stages. Mm-hmm. But when it's a universal loss, it's much harder, I think.
Tuhua gabai you to get a little tenure. And of Tuhua, ko, social musui, pole kanai. Agua gabai you, casino, Tuhua, one end.
Casino, you let me see my own.
He said there is nobody creating this loss.
No. It's defilement alone.
It's the defilements. It is not persons damaging the environment, it is defilements. He says, when we don't see the personal, we will have less defilements towards the phenomena that's at work. When we think somebody is doing it, we will feel angry with those persons. When we see the phenomena
at work,
because there is delusion, that is why this is being He says there are how many billion people in this world?
Seven
billion people in this world. He says, what percentage do you think are wise and what percentage is good? That's what Buddha said.
We just change ourselves and don't do anything about it.
He says, do what you can, what you have to accept, what you can't. Acceptance. Yes.
If what we need to do is be aware and practice awareness from moment to moment,
yes,
and just do this, then what part does retreats play in it? You know, why do we come to retreats? If
practice.
We already know the answer, that's what we need to be doing.
Practice and get more knowledge. ก็ပြောရဲကိုကအမြဲတည်းချမ်းမြောက်မယ်ဆိုရင်လည်း retreat ဝင်တာပါအပြည့်တော့
အပြည့်တော့အပြည့်တော
့အပြည့်တော့ねဟိုကယူတော့မှလ
ား knowledge လာဒါလာဒီလိုလိုဒါ
knowledge retreat is for practice. You have more time to dedicate to this exclusively.
ချင်းကိုရတော့ဘာ
အပြည့်
တော့
yes it gets stronger the practice. The second thing is you have a teacher. You can learn more. Maybe you're off on a wrong tangent, and they can set you right.
So it would be good to do as many as you can.
And I'll go retreat long like the level. If you have the time, why not?
Yeah, totally. I'm a high school student. I'm a high school student. I'm a high school student. I'm a high school student.
When he started practicing in lay life, because he was depressed, it's true he was already skillful at the practice, but he didn't have time to go for retreat anymore because he was running a business. So he practiced every day, very dedicatedly at home, and then he would go and talk to his teacher, maybe once a month, twice a month, when he had the time, he would go and discuss with his teacher. But his retreat was at home. His home was his center.
Coffee shop was the Dhamma hall.
His coffee shop was the Dhamma hall.
Wedding hall was the Dhamma hall.
The wedding hall was the Dhamma hall too. He was told to go to attend weddings, not just his own. And he would go to attend weddings for his family. You know, that's what they have to do in Asia. Somebody must represent the family and go and attend a wedding. If you're invited, you can go. At first, he hated it.
It
was like, so many people, I don't want to go, I don't meditate. I like, so much. Then he began to realize, this is aversion, it's dosa. So he challenged himself. He said, all this And then he remembered his teacher's instruction. You're not supposed to remove the object. You're supposed to not develop aversion because of the object. You're not supposed to try and get rid of the object.
Challenging.
So he
go, practice.
Give himself a challenge.
The experience, the surrounding, what? Aversion machine out of the Kunan.
So then, if he could go to that environment and then maintain his awareness and not become averse, he had won the challenge. Mm-hmm. That was how he took it. He even went for a boxing match.
Is that the same challenge you have if you have, like, I'm a school teacher, so often you have a child or a student, you have an aversion to just a personality thing.
Oh, yes.
So is that the same challenge? I mean, is it mindful to recognize the aversion? Or is it more, and sort of avoid it and maybe child move into the class, which we can?
He's a change of idea. Change your idea.
Mm-hmm.
He says, you are not this boy. Child. He says, the child is the child and you are
you.
How can you be the same? How can the child be the way you want? Let the child be how he
wants. I teach juvenile prisoners.
Oh, sorry. He says, so this is going to be their personality. This is going to be a part of what they're like. See it as it is.
In developing mindfulness, do I therefore try to create a situation where I can actually feel warmth with them?
When
you can understand it, I don't know how you will understand, but when there is enough wisdom pertaining to this person or this situation, I won't say person, pertaining to this person, their defilements and so on, he says then, if you feel wholesome to, if you have the wisdom to feel wholesome towards this person, you will, depending on the situation, feel either metta or compassion or mudita or upekkha towards the person. You may not always be
warm.
But it really depends on you. It just requires for the aversion not to be there. Once the aversion is not there, other things become possible. You should take responsibility for your own anger.
Okay, but then you must be neutral with the person.
If we are able, if we have the ability, of course it's much more peaceful for us, but only if we have the...
But
it doesn't mean not caring about them. It means that they might be doing something terrible and you understand that's what's happening to it and you don't feel affected. Parents with their children, maybe very badly behaved children, and being able to not be affected by the child, not take it personally, you know, understand that this is where the child is right now. Not be swayed either way, He said he just, like the example he gave about his sister and his mom, he says at that point, when he got to that point, yes, he was able to maintain his upekkha. He didn't think about them anymore. He just maintained his upekkha.
Would it be helpful in that situation? Because I deal with difficult children too, to focus on the child's defilements, like you said about nature, it's called by defilements, the problem in nature. So I was wondering whether it would be helpful, instead of seeing that child as being destructive or angry or whatever, to look at it more that this poor person is generating anger or aversion, and that's causing this situation. If you are able to, sometimes you
We must understand the nature of delusion, and there's a lot of
it.
He says when he was all his life, he couldn't love his father a lot, because he was very naughty when he was young. He was uncontrollable. So he got beaten a lot. Of the 10 children his father had, he was the most rebellious. His father could lock him in the toilet in the dark and he wouldn't be afraid. So it didn't matter. He could beat him. All he knew was the pain at that time. Then he would go and do whatever he wanted and get beaten again. But, you know, so he got beaten a lot. So he loved his father. I mean, that's natural. He said, but he couldn't love him a lot. That was not that warm. It didn't come. He says, and then much later, after he became a monk and when he was at the center and all that, much later in his father's life, he said, he said while he was practicing at home and his practice had become quite developed in before he became a monk, he says he began to understand the nature of moha, of delusion, and then began to understand what led to that. His father did what the best thing he knew. He didn't know how to deal with this child, and that led to that situation. And then he felt more warmth towards his father.
Yeah, I've worked with difficult children too, and I found that through a relationship, first of all, you have to establish a relationship, and then through that, you can actually. I've never found a child yet that didn't have some good, not just defilements, but had some good side to them.
Yeah.
And then you just work with that to seed and try to nurture that.
Yes. He says, all these children, he says, they also function from the place of whatever they understand. And they might have wrong understanding. What they can't understand, they can't produce. They can't function out of that space. So that's where they're at. So what you can help them to do is to understand a bit more. Tu apa yang orang, amian kelir ini tu kalau lokal orang cima, amian turun ni, macam mana orang turun ni koma, sesa musia, turun ni koma relationship tu koma, nampak siapa? Erama kuat tu ye account.
Kau mau di mana? Tu account nak surai di mana tu kalau?
Erama ay account boleh lu ya.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, so that building of a relationship is very important because that allows
you
to see. He says he was so naughty at home, and his father would go and complain about him in the monastery. But he was very good with his teacher was very good with him, so. He was good at meditating. The teacher would always say to his father, there is good in the child. At home he's the worst, actually. But at the center he was the best. At the meditation center, at his teacher's monastery he was the best. Because his teacher never told him what was negative. Only pointed out the positive for him. So to his teacher he would tell him everything. He would tell him what he did wrong, what he did right, because he had no fear that his teacher would reprimand him or say this is not right. His teacher would only listen. And then, point out the room.
What is the best way to deal with the defilements? This was a question once I asked someone, and
deal with the defilement.
And the answer was this.
Yes,
as follows. This is very simple.
Yes.
Look at the defilement.
Yes.
Keep on looking at the defilement with increasing attention, and then you will see the defilement. Once you've seen the defilement, it's not a defilement.
Right. Let's talk about wisdom already.
Mm-hmm.
The best way to deal with the defilement. Kill it out. When you see that the defilement is just a dharma, it's just another dharma, then you've
done it.
If we don't see the defilement as defilement, what do we see it as? It's dharma, nature.
Akusala dharma, kusala dharma, dharma ni.
Kusala and akusala both dharma. Akusala dharma, kusala dharma.
Yes, Sadhguru is telling us to practice awareness in our everyday life.
Mm.
How much importance does he put on sitting on the cushion?
Sienna sits about twice a day. When he was in lay life, he would sit once in the morning and once at night. But in between, throughout the day, he would take every opportunity to be in himself quietly. So sitting for him means being with yourself quietly. So if he was... Maybe he was sitting one day in the
was
shop.
Was he down with a blue painter?
Maybe he was sitting one day in the shop. Maybe he was sitting drinking coffee in the coffee shop.
Probably shut up with the Mahavan.
So long he, you know, when he wasn't interacting with his customers and just being by himself, those were all minutes of sitting.
I don't know, I think, like, I'm kind of, I look to be there.
So basically, he just never let his mind be
free.
He gave the
mind
work to do.
And free, I mean, if he did that, so go on.
To let his mind be free at that time was very dangerous. The moment he wasn't aware, his mind would start thinking, and then he would get depressed again. And then he doesn't know when the problems start beginning. And then if he had let his mind, you know, be free, not being mindful, and then if somebody came with a problem, he'd just explode because he couldn't deal with it. Because he was depressed, so everything would frustrate him. So then he had to keep himself ready all the time, always mindful. So when he was idle, his mind would be busy. You know, when he was physically idle, his mind would always be busy keeping watch.
But how did Sarada develop that desire and that intensity of goodness?
That was also an insight.
Sarah
started practicing, trying to practice continuously because he was depressed. He already knew how to practice. He didn't really believe that it would work off his depression. He didn't believe it because he was so depressed, he didn't think anything would get rid of it. But he knew it gave him some relief. So he practiced just because it offered some relief. And then as he practiced, over a few months, one day he had this experience where, as usual, he used an inhaler, a Vicks inhaler, so to sharply bring attention to his breath because he had such a, when you breathe in strong, it's a ball in my hair. So he'd have to use that. That's how scattered his mind was, because he's depressed. And that day, he took a breath, he was aware, and then for a split second, he said he felt free. That feeling of depression completely lifted. And then he said right after, it was right back. But he says that split second, his mind completely understood, this is the way
up.
And he says after that, his mind, the samvega became very strong. The faith in it was so strong. Then he began really practicing like a real.
Question, we're having a philosophical discussion yesterday on enlightenment, and the question was, is an enlightened person, do they have to maintain that enlightenment? So some teachers say you can lose the enlightenment, you have to keep practicing.
Which level of enlightenment?
Well, some people say there's enlightening rather than enlightenment, because you keep constantly...
Right. Okay, so in the Theravada, Seattle agrees with the enlightening, but only as far as Vipassana jnanas are concerned, the insights are concerned. And it's the same with awareness, samadhi. He says, because the mind always arises to pass away, he says, we cannot hang on to the quality unless we develop one more time. It leaves the legacy, so it's there, but if you don't practice it one more time, it gets less. So it's always up and down. So you have to be aware all the time, so the awareness will become stronger and stronger. If you stop being aware, awareness will get weaker and weaker. If you have an insight into anatta, dukkha, anicca, whatever, he says you have to continue to be aware to allow that understanding to continue to be fresh in the mind. If you don't, the understanding will fade as the awareness fades. So that is true. That is the enlightening bit. But in Theravada, there is the Nagajnana and the Palajnana. If you become enlightened to that degree, then it's permanent. That bit is impermanent. That bit cannot be taken away from you. Yeah.
You don't forget.
What is the
when you become a stream enter, a sotupanna, from that moment it's permanent. You cannot escape
nirvana.
See, I don't mention this yesterday evening, and he's going to mention it to you today. Because of what happened at the juice session yesterday, you know, when he was talking to people, and then we've had a few days of somewhat of silence, he would like to suggest that everybody talk during the juice time. He doesn't say it's a must. He says, maybe do talk. If you do talk, maybe take one person to talk to. But he said to the group yesterday, you must first be mindful. The key is to be mindful. He's not saying talk. He's saying be mindful. So it's a chance to be mindful while you talk, but it's not a free fest to start blabbering. Yeah, he said it is very helpful. It's not that you're going to immediately become able to speak mindfully and wisely during the juice sessions in these 3 days, but it's a beginning to understanding how to try. So you must plan how you're going to be mindful when you talk. Yes, because this is something that you can bring outside. There are a lot of you who might already be doing it at home outside, but just to practice. So choose one person, talk. If you don't talk, it's fine, but if you want to try.
He
tried it in the Czech Republic, and the yogis found it beneficial to have some limited
meditation.
But because you must be mindful first, he says, then he did notice that the yogis didn't just like erupt into loud and incessant chatter, you know, because the very guiding principle is being mindful first. If you can't be mindful, then you must stop first and regain your mindfulness before you begin again.
Okay. Our
weakness in our practice, he notices generally in yogis, is awareness of seeing, awareness of hearing, and awareness
looking, listening, talking.
And talking. So he says we must consciously practice it. So we must plan to practice it so that we get the practice in. He says, especially when people talk to each other and they don't have the same ideas, it gets very interesting. he mentioned just now, he's not saying, like, just start talking the rest of the retreat. He really wants us to remember that the first principle is be mindful. So even before, if you need to talk, you think first, I need to say this, then you're mindful and then you say it. So always to remember to be mindful first.
Okay, then thank you.
Thank you.